Okay, just before I start, I want to thank Andrew for giving me flashbacks to being a zoology undergraduate working on broiler chicken welfare, but also some of the issues around animal welfare and the science of animal welfare are very, very relevant to this case. So I'm going to crack on, partly initially to give you an extremely potted history of bovine TB, particularly in the UK. So existing histories of bovine TB basically start around the late 19th century with Koch and the understanding that this is some sort of zoonotic disease, and the long, slow story of how the disease has been controlled through the 20th century. But it is ultimately a story of triumph over disease. But most of these histories stop around 1950. However, in the UK, since 1950, this is what we've seen. So this is the late 50s and the 60s, this is the 70s, this is the 80s, this is the 90s, this is 2001, and so on. So what I'm dealing with is a situation where the existing historiography is about a very different time. What else we've happened since, and this is actually very nebulous terrain, and this is what my new Wellcome Fellowship is going to be investigating in more detail, is this period from the late 60s up until the 90s. What we had is in the late 60s, the disease was largely under control, but MAF vets were finding there were particular farms who kept getting outbreaks, and so they were going to those farms in Cornwall and Gloucestershire and trying to figure out what was going on. In 1971, they found this a specific tuberculous badger on one of these farms. Post-mortem was done, papers were published, the argument was made that this was the source of these persistent infections. Within a couple of years, we had new legislation, partly to protect badgers, because there had also been conflict over badgers as wildlife and badgers as animals who were subject to persecution and needed to be protected going on at the same time. But the Badgers Act also brought in a legislative framework to government license culling for disease control. We then had a period of various culling policies of various sorts through the 1970s and 80s, and also two expert reviews in 1980 and 1986, both by zoologists asked to come in and review the evidence and see what was going on and decide what we should do next. Moving into the main phase that I'm going to be talking about today, this continued until 1996. So at the height of the BSE crisis, the then Agriculture Minister asked the ecologist John Krebs to do another expert review. And I'll come on to Krebs' conclusions in a bit more detail in a minute, but essentially this led to the commissioning of a very large field trial to test the effect of badger culling on disease rates in cattle. Since then, which that field trial published and concluded in 2007, we've had multiple different policies in the UK, across the UK as a whole, but also in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, because we've had devolution of agricultural policy, but all largely justified on a very similar evidence base. What we've also seen over this period, this late 20th century, is that bovine TB has become reframed. So during the 1950s, the WHO is talking about zoonosis and using bovine TB as its primary example. By the end of the 20th century, what we have, so earlier we have basically two framings as public health and as animal health that are very congruent, that are working in the same direction. Now we have two framings in terms of animal health or wildlife, and wildlife protection, environmental protection. And those two framings are conflicted and actually mutually exclusive. So there's your potted history. So I'm going to be talking today primarily about this culling trial, the RBCT, the randomised badger culling trial. So when Krebs was asked to review the evidence, he got together a small expert group in the way of these things, of fellow ecologists and statisticians, I think possibly some animal health, but not so much. And they concluded that the evidence that was there already, because there had already been a research program trying to investigate this since the beginning of the 1970s, largely carried out by veterinary epidemiologists and vets working within MAF, he concluded that that evidence was quite strong that badgers were carrying TB, but that evidence was circumstantial. A lot of it was correlational analyses, geographical investigations, things like that. Krebs said what was needed was a proper experiment to base TB policy on. So this is the quote which then subsequently is used by the group doing the scientific trial to reinforce what they're doing. So he says that a proper experimental assessment is the only way to test rigorously the effectiveness and cost-effectiveness of different strategies and to provide a sound basis for future policy. So he's saying some quite strong things about the science that had been done before, about the science that he's envisioning, and also about what that science can do for politicians and policymakers. He proposed essentially a design that was something like a randomised control trial that's used in medicine, and he talked about this as something like an RCT. So comparing different culling treatments and seeing the whole idea as the land as the patient almost. So the three conditions were essentially testing culling no matter what was going on, culling only in reaction to an outbreak of TB in cattle, and a control condition where no culling was done, but badgers were surveyed and information was gathered, so kind of like monitoring the patient. And the following year, the Conservative government came out, New Labour came in, and the independent scientific group was set up in order to carry out this proposed research programme. Interestingly, the early ISG reports and the Krebs report, when it was submitted, were given to Jack Cunningham, who was the first Labour Environment Secretary, Agriculture, who then went on to run the Cabinet Office and drive forward the whole agenda around evidence-based policy. The ISG was, like the Krebs group, very multidisciplinary. The group involving animal health researchers, three different sorts of statisticians, an ecologist, an agricultural economist, and an immunologist. And this is kind of how they envisaged the research design would look. Krebs originally talked about squares, 100 kilometre squares, so a bit like kind of quadrants. But they argued that instead what you need is circles, because that kind of, they fit together better. So this is the ISG. I'm not going to say much about that so far, other than that you have old men and young women, which I think is kind of interesting. And there is some significance to that, which I'll come back to. So they started working on taking Krebs's actually quite sketchy research design and turning it into something that could be implemented. So the first thing that they did is they had to take this idea of triplets and actually translate it into places. And this is quite a tortuous process. So initially they had to do an awful lot of survey work in order to identify the particular areas that the experiment was going to be done on. So here we have one of the particularly significant things here is that when they're doing the mapping, they have to take account of landowning boundaries, but they also have to take account of badger territories. So those idealised squares have then turned into circles and have now turned into these slightly wonky, messy shapes that fit onto a real landscape. So this is eventually the entire testing areas. And one of the things that's worth noting is that initially the triplets were supposed to be very close together to make them comparable. But what actually happens sometimes is some of these triplets migrated quite a lot. And that was to do with a combination of essentially human factors that I'll come back to. So the practicalities of mapping it onto the land, the necessities of getting consent, So rather than consent from the patient, you had to get consent from the landowner. What they didn't get, it was consent from other people, which I'll come on to in a sec. Also, the whole issue of animal welfare was very, very crucial. And this is where animal welfare science is actually very significant in terms of not just that you need to cull badgers, but how do you cull the badgers? Is the culling that you're doing humane or not? And some of the earlier methods that were used to cull were not considered to be humane. This is partly a very serious scientific and moral issue, but it also was a legal requirement that they had to actually deal with while they were designing the experiment. They then had to deal with landowners who just didn't want anything to do with it. They also had to deal with a lot of what they described as interference. So this was essentially welfare activists going in and interfering with the experiment because they objected to it. Just to illustrate how this works is that this is actually a picture from one of the current vaccination trials, but the procedure is very much the same as what was used in the RVCT. So essentially you trap your badger, you catch your badger, you come along a bit later in the day, you shoot your badger. But it means from the point of view of somebody who wants to interfere with that process, it's very, very easy to do so. And so several areas had to be moved or abandoned because of the degree of interference with the sets, but also harassment of people trying to do the work. So all of this was going on in terms of trying to actually make this experiment real. Then 2001 came along, and we had the foot and mouth disease outbreak, which completely threw everything up in the air. The entire field experiment had to be stopped for a year, partly because all the people who were doing the RBCT had to be basically removed into dealing with foot and mouth disease. It also meant that all the routine paraphernalia of controlling TB was also suspended during that year. So there was no routine testing, there was no controls, so on and so forth. All of that just stopped for a year. And when it came back in, the initial thing that was found very quickly, that there had been a big spike in disease. What was also found quite shortly after that was that they were getting some very unexpected findings. So the reactive culling condition, so this is when you go in and cull badgers because there has been a local outbreak, was actually increasing the disease rates by about 30%. The ISG reported this to ministers quite quickly, and very immediately afterwards, ministers actually just terminated that condition. So you've gone from a design that's supposed to have two experimental conditions and a control to one where one of those experimental conditions is just stopped, and you've only got the other one in the control. So another modification, as it were. So by now, this is 2004, by the way. Then in 2007, you finally get the final report. The work is finally completed. The ISG have sat down and done their analysis and tried to figure out what on earth is going on. One of the things I would say is that right from the beginning, the ISG quite forcefully asserted that their remit was about providing evidence, but also about providing policy advice for ministers. So they were asserting quite a broad remit, in a way that's kind of unfamiliar now and I think has changed. So their final report essentially said, reactive culling, terrible idea, don't do it. Proactive culling, so this is the idea that you go into an area before that you know there's been outbreaks and you take out the badgers. They found that that was kind of working within the area. It was taking it down a bit, but the surrounding areas, you were getting an increase in disease. And they had brought in quite a comprehensive theoretical explanation as to why that happens, which is theory from ecology called perturbation. Essentially, the idea is that the badgers are very territorial, they have a social structure. If you disrupt that social structure, they move around a lot more, and because they're moving around more, they're spreading disease more. They also concluded that it was just not cost-effective. As I say, that agricultural economist, the work he's doing, is a fundamental part of the programme. almost immediately after they reported, the chief scientist at the time, David King, was asked by ministers to produce his own report on the ISG's findings. Now, this went back to ministers within 6 weeks, but it wasn't made public until later in the year for complicated reasons. But King got together his own expert group, which actually consisted more of one ecologist, but three veterinarians, of veterinary scientists of various sorts. This report directly contradicted the ISG. It said that culling can work, but one of the ways that they did this was essentially by cake cutting, by saying, well, this part is the science and the evidence, and this part is not. And what they excluded was the cost-benefit analysis, the considerations of how you do this in the real world, the animal welfare requirements were all essentially excluded. Kind of a great deal of mess ensued and continues to ensue. But that year, what you had by the end of the year is that you had King and members of the ISG essentially fighting in the mass media and also on the benches of a parliamentary inquiry that was going on at the time. I have a great quote from one of the MPs who was involved in that inquiry saying that the atmosphere when they were taking evidence from both sides was comparable to or possibly worse than Prime Minister's questions. So it was really not a good atmosphere. What we found is that the various people involved in the RBCT changed their position about science. So initially, anti-culling activists were against the RBCT and they did not want it to happen. Whereas farmers, the NFU, were very in favour of the RBCT because they thought it would provide science, provide evidence to legitimate the culling policy. Then, of course, the RBCT findings said the opposite and everybody swapped position. The King reanalysis and this kind of cake cutting also provided the basis of the reanalyses that the Coalition have done to just to talk about why they should be coming. So, to try and wind up, what kind of experiment was the RBCT? I'm going to be a bit controversial here in a session about agricultural experiments, but I think the RBCT is an experiment about agriculture, but it's not an agricultural experiment, which sounds like a bit of an odd thing to say. It's not very much like a crop trial. You are dealing with patches of land, but those patches of land are huge, and the entities that you're manipulating are complicated animals, farms, farmers, other people, so on and so forth. The only place where I think it is comparable is a bit of work on GM crop trials, where, again, this kind of matter of people objecting to the science being done in their space is very, very similar. The RBCT, particularly in the way that Krebs wrote about it, but also the ISG, was constructed in opposition to the previous veterinary epidemiology and animal health research. So it certainly wasn't an experiment like that. That was the whole point, is that it was a new kind of experiment. Krebs also rhetorically talked about it as an RCT, a medical RCT. And certainly it was comparing multiple treatments against a control. There was a big stress on the randomization. So those three conditions were not assigned until the very last minute. However, of course, the people living in those areas, once it started, were very, very well aware of which condition was which. You couldn't do anything like a placebo. And, of course, you've only got one trial. The whole point of evidence-based medicine now is that you don't have one RCT. You have thousands of them, and you compare. I feel that, in a lot of ways, the RBCT is actually much more like a behavioural ecology experiment, an ethology experiment. Krebs himself was, and still is, a highly influential ecologist. If you look at the idea of manipulating behaviour in the field, in that way, a lot of what was trying to be done with the RBCT is quite like Tinbergen's experiments of kind of painting eggs different colours and moving them around and see what the birds do. However, it's also unique, And it's not like any of these, in, particularly in terms of the sheer scale of the experiment. The area, the numbers of animals, then the numbers of humans involved in terms of making the experiment happen, but also people living with the experiment. And this is the other thing that makes it very different, is that it was being conducted in public, very literally in public, in land that people live in, which makes it quite different from quite a lot of field science. So, and this is my last slide. This is just going to talk about why now, basically 20 years on, we're kind of in a worse mess than we were when Krebs reported in 97. So Mandy Rees has written about the idea of the fieldwork as regress in primatological research. But in any experiment, if somebody wants to critique an experiment, you can infinitely pick at the circumstances of the experiment. When you're trying to do work in the field, this is very much worse, simply because you're working in the field. It's not such a controllable environment. Also, particularly specifically with primatology, you have the whole issue of whether what the experimenter is doing is affecting how the animals are behaving. The animals will feed back, and their behaviour feeds back with the behaviour of the experimenter, and that could be a problem. If you look at the major critiques of the RBCT, they were very much along these lines. Particularly, there was a massive focus on the compromises of the research design, the numbers of times when the one condition was abandoned, that traps were interfered with, that they weren't killing all the animals in the first place because of animal welfare considerations, so on and so forth. So very obvious boundary work around what counts as science is also going on in the critiques. And also, what I'm describing is kind of cape cutting around science and policy, which is not quite the same as boundary work. So the role that the ISG claimed as providers of evidence, but also as policy advisors, is something that particularly post the whole affair with David Nutt is now not really a terribly legitimate position. Also, the whole rhetoric of evidence-based policy. If science becomes just evidence, then how can scientists be experts? There's some interesting conundrums there. So essentially, I think that the RBCT is kind of subject to the fieldworkers' regress squared or quadrupled, because it's a field experiment to start with. It's being conducted at an unprecedented scale. The topic then is being really fiercely contested, not amongst one core set, but two very, very different core sets, one around ecology and statistics and animal behaviour research, and one about veterinary science and farming and agriculture. Thirdly, you have the experiments being conducted in lived public space under very, very intense public scrutiny. And that makes it very, very different from lots of field science. Finally, there's the whole issue of expectations of what science can do in the first place. And it's very clear that ministers in 98 did very much expect this science to give them evidence, to give a clear policy, and then everyone would shut up and stop complaining. But it wasn't just the politicians. If I can get back to the slide. So, again, that statement from Krebs, repeated by the ISG, is making a very clear promise about what science can do, which actually kind of opens up the science itself to exactly this kind of criticism. If you're making unrealistic promises about science, particularly about the science around something this messy, and then it turns out to be really messy, then you've kind of cut your own feet off, essentially. Now we have a situation where basically everyone involved in the argument is saying, the science says, thing I support. And this isn't particularly helpful for solving the problem. It's not particularly helpful in terms of the public image of science or the relationship between scientists and policymakers. So as to where we go next, I don't know, but I think this is why we're in the mess we're in.
Okay, thank you.